Welcome back to week two of looking at Proverbs here this summer. We had a good conversation last week, kind of covering some of the basic background info, which conveniently we've got a ton of the part one handouts there, so feel free to take one of those for yourself if you weren't here last time to see what you missed and use as a reference. But so this week, the way that I've decided to kind of divide this up, because if you just read Proverbs through cover to cover, it's really hard to just do like, we're going to do chapter X, Y, and Z this week, because so much of the book is, well, Proverbs, like these, kind of one-off sayings and stuff. Where if you've got a chapter that has like 25 verses in it, each 25 of the 25 verses might deal with an entirely different topic. So it's a little hard to do any kind of organized look at stuff by just reading through it. So we're going to approach things kind of topically and, be pulling like things from all over kind of around a theme. So this week's theme, as I think is kind of befits talking about the book of Proverbs, is what is wisdom? So I actually wanted to start that off by asking you guys the same question. When you hear that word wisdom, what do you think of? How would you define what it means to be wise? Because I feel like it's one of those concepts where, like, we talk about, it's important to live wisely, spend your money wisely. We look for, people in leadership positions to have wisdom. What do we mean when we say that, right?
Intelligence, for one thing.
I'd say it is certainly, can be a part of it, yeah. Like, I would say I have met intelligent people who are not wise, but I have not met very unintelligent people who are wise. Which, by full disclosure here, I'd like to think I'm a reasonably intelligent person. That does not mean that I have not had moments like the time when I tried to open my office door at the church in Chicago with my car key clicker and was very confused as to why it wouldn't open. With the sad reality of that being that it was 8 o'clock in the morning and what I probably needed was a cup of coffee, but the coffee maker was on the other side of the locked door. So I moved it. 10 minutes after that, but it's like, let's put this in the fellowship hall. Anyways, so when we, it may be almost easier to define than what is wisdom. Who is somebody that you have looked at and seen as an example of somebody who you would consider to be wise? Somebody with like lots of experience, yeah. Like I know for me, one of the people that I always looked to very specifically was a teacher that I had in high school, who I had actually for my 10th grade Bible class, and she was my AP English teacher in 11th and 12th grade. And she was always one of those people who, when she was the kind of teacher who cared about you outside of the classroom as much as she did inside. And when I would sit down with her, I'd be talking about, whatever life's challenge of the week was then. She always was the kind of person who was just a remarkably good listener. And then would be able to offer a perspective on stuff that both was like very compassionate and understanding about why as a 16-year-old I thought the world was ending because of, X, Y, or Z. But then also be able to like point past that with years of experience of life to kind of point toward a way to like move past the hang up and into something better. I think when I think of wise people, I a lot of times think of like those kind of mentor type figures, right? The people who you want to learn from because they've got the experience, because they seem to care, because they seem invested, and they may be the kind of person who can have a sense of humor and goof around, but they also know when to be serious and take things seriously too, right? So, The first 9 chapters of Proverbs, which is 31 chapters, as we talked about last week, growing up, Brother Sid, the pastor at the little Southern Baptist church that I went to as a kid, always threw out there that, like, if you're looking for something to do for, you know, reading the Bible on your own, you can read a chapter of Proverbs a day because there's 31, so it's easy to not lose your place as long as you've got a calendar. The first 9 chapters of it, so we're talking like ish the first third of the book, like between a quarter and a third, is really devoted in large measure to the question of what is wisdom, what does it look like, where does it come from, what are its kind of like its trademarks so that we can tell what true wisdom is. And what its opposite is. What is folly? What does it look like to be a foolish person instead of wise? Because Proverbs holds in tension throughout the entire book the idea of the wise versus the foolish. That there is a way of being wise, but that has an opposite too. There is a way of being foolish in the world. So, chapters 1, 2, chapters 1, 3, 8, and 9 principally focus on that question of what does wisdom look like? Now, we don't get a super, like, pithy, just one-off, like, wisdom is blank kind of statement in there. But we can start piecing together a picture of what it looks like. If folks want to grab pew Bibles from there in front of you, I would take a volunteer who would be willing to look up Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. I'm actually going to grab one here for myself to make sure I tell folks the right, you know, chapter and verse numbers. So if you're looking for where Proverbs is in the Bible, it's in the middle right after the Psalms. So I would ask for another volunteer to find Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. Another person to find chapter 8, verses 8 through 9. And then I will take chapter 9, verse 10. So now that's a lot of numbers there, but do we have somebody who's looked up that verse in chapter 1? If not, that's fine. I can go to it real quick. Chapter 1, verse 7.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. All right. Who did anybody get to chapter 3, verses 5 and 6?
Yes. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not rely on your own insight. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make straight paths.
Very good. So I think I told a sneak thing that I referenced last week while we were talking, and sneak peek to next week's video sermon. This is the first set of Bible verses I had to memorize as a student at the Christian school, was the beginning of Proverbs chapter 3. All right, did anybody make it to chapter 8, verses 8 and 9? Oh, I think we got 3 people who all got there. If somebody wants... Okay, yep. If one of you wants to do 8 and another person wants to do chapter 9, verse 10.
Chapter 9, verse 10 says,
all the words of my mouth are righteous. There is nothing twisted or crooked in them.
Yep.
In 9 chapter, chapter 9, verse, what, 10?
Yes, first time.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight.
Here we go. So I think we've got a pretty consistent theme, though, that crops up there in each of these four chapters to kind of dwell on the question of what is wisdom, which is that it's fundamentally rooted in a respectful understanding of God, who God is, and how God operates in the world. Like, that's the beginning point of it, which is a unique perspective that Proverbs offers up around that question of wisdom, because I feel like if we're pressed to start defining wisdom, we start naming a lot of characteristics that are not incompatible with wisdom. But outside of like church circles, we don't usually rush to, oh, well, it's somebody who has, you know, whose understanding of the world is rooted, you know, in faithfulness and, you know, relationship with God. Like, that's kind of like the defining point of like what wisdom in Proverbs looks like, is it finds its start there. Now we hear that phrase, the fear of the Lord, here. And I think it's worth taking a moment to define that, because when we see fear there, that tends to, you know, when we hear fear in 2026, like, we tend to think terror, being afraid of something, you know. I fear what might happen if a, you know, really bad storm, you know, comes and knocks down my house. Like, I fear bad things that might happen. The understanding of fear that's rooted here, if you go back to the Hebrew, is less what we'd call fear in modern English and a little more rooted in the idea of like reverence or respect. It's kind of a knowing your place, knowing who is God and who is not. In terms of the perspective, it's rooted more than anything in humility, in that understanding that we are not the ones who create the universe. We are not the ones who frame the entirety of everything that exists. We are not the ones who have all of the power to do things, shape things. Like, we are finite. There are limits to what we can know. There are limits to what we can do. So we find like our rootedness and our, you know, sense of identity and place in recognizing who and what we are and who and what God is in comparison to humanity, at least in Proverbs. Now, this is, I think it's interesting because the parts of this that are attributed to Solomon, we tend to hear as being rooted in like kind of his prime years of being the wise king of Israel, the whole region looks to as being an example of a wise ruler. Well, at the same time, if you read in like the book of 1 Kings about Solomon's life and work, you see him actually violating lots of the principles that he lays out here of what a wise person does. Like, Solomon has literal hundreds of wives and 700 concubines. Solomon, because of, you know, his deciding that, you know, why choose when you can have the whole buffet, ends up having a large number of, you know, wives whose faiths would be anathema to, you know, Hebrew religious sensibilities. And Solomon ends up going like, okay, cool. Like, I'll play the field there too. And, you know, constructing idols and temples to all manner of other gods, which in the Hebrew scriptures is like the thing you do not do, like number one, you know, like quite literally first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. And it's what Solomon does. So already we get like this interesting tension of the, you know, person whose life is wisdom, who is defining what it means to be wise for us, not necessarily following his own wise advice about it a whole lot, Which is why humility is a fantastic place for us to find the beginning of wisdom here. Because, well, maybe we don't have it all figured out. Maybe if even Solomon, the person who supposedly had it the most figured out of us, still struggles with what does it mean to be wise and actually follow through all the time on that, maybe we do a little better to remember our place too and take our perspectives, our interpretations, our wisdom as being nothing but mere reflections of a greater wisdom. So you'll find too, like particularly in chapters 1, 8, and 9, that wisdom itself is given kind of a persona in this introductory section. We see actually wisdom portrayed as kind of, I've heard her referred to as like Lady Wisdom or Dame Wisdom, this, you know, kind of feminine personification of wisdom. The word for wisdom in Hebrew, chokhmah, is a feminine noun. Same in Greek, Sophia. So, understandably, like the presentation in scripture follows like that line of, well, it's a feminine verb, so wisdom's a girl, grammatically speaking, at least. And so we get wisdom out here literally like telling us, like, come to me, come into my house, be part of what I have to offer in the world here. And in chapter 9, we actually get both wisdom and folly personified, where wisdom is inviting you to come into abundance and life, and folly is sitting around saying, well, I'll just go ahead and read it because I'm right open at it. She sits at the door of her house on a seat at the high places of the town, contrasts the idea of humility right here, calling to those who pass by, who are going straight on their way, you who are simple, turn in here. And to those without sense, she says, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. So ill-gotten gains. But they do not know that the dead are there, and that her guests are in the depths of Sheol, the grave, in Hebrew. So not only is there a sense that, like, wisdom, being wise, is connected in with, you know, humbly navigating life, there's a sense too in which the way of wisdom is the way of life itself. It is not just a way to live, it should be the way to live that yields tremendous benefits for people. But not just in terms of your own personal benefit. So certainly there are verses throughout here that, again, like, I could probably rattle off and could, like, popcorn read, but we'll take a pass on that, where, like, the fruits of wisdom are long life, health, wealth, comfort, stability, peace, all of these kinds of things, in contrast with the way of folly. But the thing about foolishness is it's not necessarily things that make you immediately unsuccessful. Because fools are presented here as not just being like the drunk dude passed out in the alley, though that's certainly an expression of foolishness. It's also the dishonest businessman. It's, you know, the person who, the adulterer who sneaks around. It's, you know, the wealthy person with dishonest scales. It's the bandit who, you know, loads up loot and plunder, you know, mounds of treasure and stuff. Like, if you're only defining success as, do you have a lot of money? Do you have a lot of resources? Are you able to live comfortably? Folly, in some cases, can get you there, at least temporarily, in Proverbs. But it's the substance that undergirds wisdom that makes it different, because the wise person doesn't have to worry about the consequences of how they made their riches, how their, you know, where their wealth comes from, where their safety and security is at. There's a sense of peace and ease with it, because the wise person is the one who, again, understands that wisdom comes principally relationally from God and following God's commandments and calling. And the goodness and the blessings flow out of that rather than being the things that you just earn on your own. Like a wise person doesn't go around like cheating their customers in order to make more money. A wise person, because that person is eventually going to get found out. They're going to get dragged into court. They may be found guilty. They may owe all of that back plus damages. The wise person practices their trade with fairness and integrity so that their name will be what sells them to other people and, you know, earns them their comfortable living. And it's like the blessings of wisdom come from, you know, the fruit of following, you know, kind of the path of goodness and mercy and righteousness that's laid out in the commandments. It's because, again, like, this is coming from the ancient Israelites, whose whole worldview is really contained in those 670-some specific commandments in the Pentateuch, you know, like places like Leviticus and the second half of Exodus and Numbers, where, you know, the dry spells, if you're trying to read your way through the Bible in a year, where, you know, you get a whole chapter on, you know, what to do with, you know, a half dozen different, like, skin conditions. Or, you know, a whole chapter, you know, laying out, like, the correct way to, you know, practice this trade, that trade, and some other trade. But for the audience who's originally receiving this, it wasn't just a list of rules to follow. It was the idea of a lifestyle rooted, again, in that sense that, like, we're a people in relationship with God, and being in relationship with God looks like living this way in the world because it's the way that God lays out and, you know, provides, you know, blessing, mercy, and grace along the way. Now, I'll say as a Lutheran, sometimes that's a struggle to get into that worldview a little bit because we put such an emphasis on, you know, we're saved by grace, we're saved by faith. They say faith, grace, for Christ's sake, apart from works. And so, like, when we come back to, like, the Hebrew scriptures for me, and there's this big sense of, like, well, you know, God's gracious presence is revealed to us and this laundry list of seemingly arbitrary things that you should do. Like, part of me kind of looks at that and balks a little bit. Like, maybe I'm just the kind of person who doesn't like being told what to do. Or I will freely admit, and my parents would probably affirm, but at the same time, like, Proverbs, what I appreciate about its perspective here is that wisdom does look like following a path, but it doesn't necessarily look like just, you know, ticking boxes either. Like, the Proverbs leaves a lot open to interpretation of, like, what does this look like in terms of how you do it? It's not, you can be an honest, you know, merchant by doing exactly these three things. It's more stresses the value of it's important to be honest and fair in your dealings with other people. So what else have we got here? So we get wisdom personified as Lady Wisdom, but we also get wisdom personified in another way, which, happy Father's Day, it's as a father giving advice to a son. Showing up here. So you can imagine, like, Solomon, like, pouring out advice, you know, on his son about, again, like, this is what wisdom looks like. That verse, like, chapter 3, is very much framed as a, like, my son, this is how you should live. So those sections also get a little, and we will, again, be pulling verses right and left out of these, like, as we kind of hit other topics over the next few months. They start introducing a little bit of that style of the, like, you know, it's like kind of the popcorn verses of, like, oh, we got this idea. Oh, we've got this idea. We've got this other idea. Here's something else entirely over there. But we do get some longer stuff again more reflections on broader themes, like avoiding evildoers and avoiding fools, like with those being usually the same thing. Like a fool is somebody who does stuff that is wrong, stuff that's evil. A fool is a dishonest person. A fool is a corrupt person. A fool is an adulterer. A fool is all of these things that it exhorts you to avoid. That too, like we've got at least a full chapter and a half here in the first 9 chapters devoted just to the theme of adultery, which I will do a brief reenactment of the most awkward school Bible study that ever occurred. So we had, my last year or two in high school, we had basically mandatory school-wide Bible study time where everybody at the end of their first period class had to pull out their Bibles and, you know, the whole school studied the same passage of scripture each day. So we were working our way through Proverbs. So a friend of mine was talking about how he had apparently gotten up to go use the restroom, and Bible study time began before he had made his way back to the classroom at the end of the hour. And so he walked into a girl in his class who had been called upon to read, because we had to read this all out loud too. Like, literally came into, like, her saying, like, right as he walks into the room, "I have decked my couch with coverings, colored spreads of Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love." Which, I'm not sure whether it was more awkward for her having to be the voice of the adulteress in chapter 7, or my friend Michael walking into like his classmate just like saying out loud, "Let's make love all night long." So again, these are the things that like students occur. Wait, what laugh? Like I know I mentioned before, like we would like during Bible class, like whisper shout, like suggestive sounding Bible verses at each other, like Song of Solomon 7:7-8, and like, you know, go look it up, and then like half the class would be snickering when they discovered that it was, you know, that one reads, you know, my beloved's stature is like that of the palm tree, and her breasts are as its clusters of fruit. And I say to myself, I will climb the palm tree. I will grasp hold of the clusters of fruit. This is also why when people start talking about Song of Solomon as a metaphor for like Christ's love for us, like I start to get a little uncomfortable, because I'm like, I love Jesus, but I would rather he not climb my palm tree, so to speak. It's like that is not a mental image I'm okay with. Probably not an example of biblical wisdom right there. The rabbit chasing with his disguise. Alright, so that was a lot, like, again, like, and I apologize for the lack of handout. That probably would have made this both a little more cohesive and a little more participatory, but let's kick it over to you guys. So, like, as you hear about this, as you, like, hear those verses that we read and think about that theme of wisdom and stuff, like, what stands out to you? What do you find affirming in your own sense of what it means to be wise? What challenges you in terms of thinking about that? Because I know for myself, like, there is an element of being told that, like, wisdom sounds like, you know, fundamentally a spiritual thing rooted in a lot of, like, applying, you know, in this very specific case, like the Torah, like Jewish law, to like daily living, which again, like as a Lutheran and the person who's been like told what to do, like steps on my toes a little bit. Like, I'm curious to hear from you guys. Like, what's the good, the bad, and the ugly?
name prior to it?
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. One, I think the nice thing with that too is that it maybe it doesn't mean there's only one thing that like wisdom looks like either. Maybe it looks like specific, you know, one set of specific actions for particular people in a particular time and place, and maybe it does look a little different in terms of how it's lived out in another era, undergirded by that same idea of, you know, it looks like honesty, it looks like uprightness, it looks like, you know, fidelity and things like that.
I have difficulty because there's so many people who pretend that they're wise and that they have wisdom and that they follow God's law and everything like that, but they really don't.
Sure. And that's a theme that's going to come up a lot over the course of Proverbs is, you know, integrity versus hypocrisy. Because you're right. I commend to anybody who's like a book called Salvation on the Small Screen by Nadia Boltz Weber, which was like kind of her first book that she's written. She's got, I want to say like maybe four or five books published at this point. But she spent 24 hours watching Christian television, like televangelist type stuff, you know, through the particular lens of like a Lutheran pastor, and very particularly Nadia Boltz Weber, who grew up, I think, like Church of Christ, and then kind of, you know, walked away from Christianity and then was led back over time by that, you know, by the message of grace and mercy that, you know, I think undergirds what we're about. And so, like, her reflections on that, and let's just say some of that mismatch between what people are saying and what people are actually doing is thought-provoking and also very colorfully written. So if you're easily offended by, like, swear words, I would not recommend that book to you, but... So as we think about all of this, again, like, I'll ask you, like, who do you look at as, you know, an example of, like, what wisdom looks like, either in your personal life or more widely in the world?
My parents were wise. They grew up at a time when it was rough, but they learned how to do things for not much money. And they raised me, at least my sister and me, we were 10 years apart. But I remember how, when I was very young, I didn't go to kindergarten only 2 weeks. I was sick all the time. So when we moved from California to Iowa, and they put me in first grade, but I wasn't doing well. They said I couldn't get better, and they put me back. My dad took that with his wisdom, and he had not finished school, but back then, they were smarter in ninth grade than we graduated in 12th grade. And he sat with me every night and taught me the alphabet. He taught me phonics. He taught me later how to go outside and do things. And he never looked at me as I never felt he ever looked at me like, you're a girl, you can't do this. Mm. No, you can do anything. And I think that is a wise thing to teach your kids.
Sure. A wise thing to teach your kid. It's like, actually, I love the way that phrase works, that it's a wise thing to teach your kids, like that they're capable and stuff. You could also just take the phrase, it's a wise thing to teach your kids. And see, actually, within that, like, really, like, a core, too, of what we get here. I mean, if wisdom is personified as, like, a parent teaching a child, like, this is what it means to, you know, live in the world well. I mean, what better expression of wisdom than to look at parents who are out there trying to do the hard work of investing in their kids to help them be people who are successful in the world, who have integrity, who know how to, you know, go out into the world and handle themselves with respect and responsibility and all these values that we talk about, right? And Yeah, again, thinking like too, like if we think like also remember that one of the most predominant images in scripture of God is of a loving parent for us. How again, like that idea of wisdom is something that finds its beginning in God. Similarly for us, like that idea of like where does wisdom comes from? Well, it comes from relationship with, you know, like the living manifestation of wisdom, you know, that we see in God. In fact, one thing that pops up here is there's a, at the end of chapter 8, and here we get this kind of, under the heading here, like wisdom's part in creation, and I'm not going to read it all, but I'll just say that like it's things like when God established the heavens, this is wisdom speaking, I was there. When God drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above and established the fountains of the deep and assigned to the sea its limit, when God made life and people, I was there. I mean, that image of wisdom being there sounds an awful lot actually like what we read in the Gospel of John about how in the beginning was the Word, the Logos, which in Greek is more than just like, you know, like a word out of your mouth. It's more the idea of all knowledge and wisdom and, you know, logic and philosophy summed up in kind of one neat package there. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelled among us, Christ. Like, Christ is the personification of wisdom in a certain way of looking at it. So people have made that connection between, you know, Proverbs 8, wisdom describing itself as, like, you know, co-creating with God, and tied it back into the co-creator with God who becomes flesh and walks among us. So another place where you get to go and see that wisdom of the Father laid out for us is when we look at, you know, who Jesus is, what Jesus does, what Jesus teaches, how Jesus lives. It's a fleshing out of that idea of wisdom for us too. Which I think for those of us who are maybe a little on the fence about, you know, letter of the law, specificity of commandments about everything from how to dig a latrine to mixed fiber clothing, there's some comfort in knowing that for those of us who proclaim Jesus as Lord, we can look at Jesus and see what God's wisdom looks like when it comes to dwell on earth.
Sure.
No, it's, I actually remember, like, and I'm not going to say my mom is always the best personification of God's wisdom here, but in this case, like, I actually have a similar memory of her when I was a kid being the one who, like, taught me how to pray and stress. It's like, you know, like, it's a good thing to do, like, every night before you go to bed. Like, that's a perfect time because you're kind of settling in and stuff, like, to, you know, say some prayers. Like, you could say this one. Like, you can tell me the, like, now I lay me down to sleep one that many of us learned as children. And, you know, the Lord's Prayer. And so, like, you know, those are starting points. And as you get bigger and older, like, you can, you know, improvise some here. But start with this.
And I think this is what, like, Proverbs, and always like, I end up being like, oh my God, you know, it's like a green card, like, pop, like you said, popcorn, where it, sure, feels, it doesn't feel very coherent. And now, obviously, I'm a little smarter, and, you know, but I think it doesn't, like, talk in themes. So I think that's where I get attention, where it's like, it gives these very specific or, like, one, two line things, or, like, you talk about, you know, the Hebrew laws about all these rules, and it doesn't elevate past those rules into, like, okay, but why? And we used to live in a very, very devout Hasidic community in Brooklyn, and I worked in a specific like restaurant and wine bar, and so all of my coworkers were like buried about Hasidic, most of them. And I, as I got to know them, I would be like, okay, I get your, you know, I get your religion, but like, help me understand why this means a lot to you. Because there's so much, there's so many laws, and there's so much process and structure to the day. So like, every time that they made a new item, which in a restaurant is really fast paced, and I'm like, let's go, and they're like doing this like blessing, they're washing their hands, they're keeping up, and like, I was like, help me understand. And they go, well, because it, like, for us, it infuses the practice into every single aspect of our being, and so it's meditative, and it's not about the law necessarily. And like, some of them are my age, and they're like, yeah, sometimes it's like, it's not about the law, it's about the practice and about the presence. And that was this aha moment of like, oh, well, I think everything would be a lot more approachable for me if like it was this like up one level of like, Scott, like what you said, like, okay, it's not necessarily about these couple of line items, it's about humility, or it's about integrity. And maybe I was just slow on the uptake, or I got like too obsessed with like the ways that it was poorly applied or like hypocritically applied. But I sometimes when I'm reading like Psalms, or not Psalms, Proverbs or other parts, I'm like, okay, like, talk more theoretically. Like,
yeah, what's the big picture?
What's the application here? And then I get frustrated when people get lost in the sauce a little bit and then use that poorly too.
Right.
So, and that's why I like Lutheranism, but at the same time, I'm like, everyone's still getting lost in the weeds a lot.
Sure.
And I wish that they were better about giving the theme first and then examples maybe or something.
Sure, yeah. No, like, I totally get that. Like, as somebody who, like, again, like, I feel like we will probably come back to multiple examples from my illustrious history of Brazosport Christian School over the course of the Book of Proverbs, given the extent to where it was applied or misapplied and, you know, life there. Like, you're talking about that, and I'm thinking about the school dress code, where everything in the student handbook had to have, like, the scripture chapter and verse next to it to justify why the school said you could wear this, you couldn't wear this, you have to shave this way, you have to do that way. And it's like, again, like, it's the, like, here, let's pull this random verse completely out of any kind of context, any kind of greater meaning. And let's say, oh, well, Jesus said, you know, don't be like the hypocrites who don't wash their faces, so you need to come, like, nicely groomed to school. It's like, that's not what that passage is actually about. It ties into a much broader theme. So why is this how we're using, you know, scripture right now to, like, you know, justify this? What's the bigger picture? What's the overarching theme? And how can we talk about maybe that instead of just, here are 10 specific things that you're supposed to do that are completely context-free, and mostly just feel, yeah, like the checklist of, like, well, God says, you know, thou shalt not have a 5 o'clock shadow until you've graduated high school. That was my one dress code infraction the entire time I was in school, was I got sent to the bathroom with a disposable razor and a can of shaving cream once because I had overslept and did not shave. And then I looked at my blonde classmates who had longer facial hair than I did but could get away with it because it was lighter colored and hid well. Cursed my, you know, half-Italian mother's genetic contributions to, you know, my appearance there. But, no, and I think to, you know, the point, too, of I think the struggle within religion always is the easy temptation to do, you know, kind of find our specific hobby horses that we are just going to ride till we can't ride them anymore and put on the blinders and just charge ahead. And we do this because this is what we do. You know, that kind of tautology of, you know, like, well, we're Lutherans, so we do this, we believe this. And thus we can reduce down, you know, the whole substance of what it means to be a person of faith, the whole substance of what it means to live in the world, down to a very, you know, kind of narrow perspective on things. And it's kind of like swimming in the ocean and thinking that the sum of the ocean is what you can see through your goggles while you're snorkeling on the surface.
Yeah.
like you're talking about the Catholics.
And the Presbyterians and the Evangelicals and so on and so forth. But I will say that that is, yes, an observation made to me by nearly every ex-Catholic that I have ever encountered. Including my mom from my earliest days on, who, the freak out she had when I told her that I was getting confirmed as a Lutheran, because her only experience of Lutheranism had been her first husband's Lutheran church services that just felt similar enough to Catholic Mass to her, to where she just kind of lumped them all in together. Oh my God, you would have thought that I had told her that I was like personally going to Bethlehem on Christmas Day to like murder Jesus like in the manger. Like, I raised you better than that. How can you go back to that?
Sounds like my sister.
But it's interesting because like there's every tradition, every religion, every group, I feel like, I mean, the number of arguments I've gotten with people where I'm like, there's bad people in every country and every religion, like, but this right. Split, there's always that split in humanity no matter what, of like the inverse of what you said, where they're like, I have a checklist in front of me, fantastic, and then I'm going to go to church, and afterwards I'm going to go, like, make someone cry at a local restaurant. Like,
right, yep.
And I don't, it's just like, I'm, I don't know, I feel like maybe this is the first place I've been where, like, I feel like I'm regularly practicing, like, taking it up a level, thinking about the theme and how that actually applies, and then a little bit of, why wouldn't everyone do that, or why wouldn't that be, like, literally the whole point?
Sure.
You know, and so I'm always confused, like, I feel like we keep giving people the opportunity to be really satisfied with, like, what they can see in their snorkel goggles, and they're like, fantastic, please go to brunch, and they don't know why.
Sure. No, I think it was a very valid observation. Like, I'm very glad that that is not your perception of how we do things here. Because, like, I certainly try to, like, point to the ocean, not just to, you know, like, the limited, like, view that we've got there. And, you know, encourage you to, like, do a little bit of your own discovering and, you know, you can go swim around the reef and, you know, see what shimmers there. You know, not you don't just have to take my word for it, and Lord knows I do not think that I am, you know, the end-all, be-all God's gift to, you know, biblical knowledge and interpretation. Because I could spend an extensive amount of time talking about the sheer number of people, places, things that have, like, shown me just, again, like, how limited my own perspective and, you know, ability to understand and interpret, you know, the scripture, faith in the world, experience, etc., which is part of why I love doing this, is it broadens my horizons, you know, because we do this together. No, like, I like you, wish that more places, more congregations, more communities were willing to kind of push folks a little bit, challenge folks to, like, ask the questions, look at, you know, look from the different angle, think a little higher and harder. But at the same time, like, I think a lot of, I will say, as somebody in ministry, that I am fortunate in that, number one, I have been blessed to have largely served my entire time since I was in field ed and seminary at congregations full of generally good-hearted folks who are willing to get challenged a little bit, willing to do some digging, and generally okay with, you know, hearing things from the pulpit or in a Bible study or what have you that might not line up with their own personal perspectives or convictions, but are said in love, and thus can be taken well, even if they go, like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. But, you know, I don't think Pastor Kevin was, like, trying to, like, stomp all over my toes here. And I wish I could say that was everybody in ministry's experience, but a lot of it, unfortunately, in plenty of churches, is there's some singing for your supper. that has to go on for folks in leadership of, you know, when the person whose financial contributions are 20% of the church's giving says, you know, you're not going to talk about blank, and you talk about it anyways, like, suddenly you're getting pulled into a surprise council meeting, like, to justify yourself and about, we don't talk about that here. Or the person who comes in and shakes, you know, shakes up tradition because we don't understand ourselves really as a community that's rooted in the gospel. We understand ourselves as a community that's rooted in preserving our, you know, sense of heritage and ancestry and identity. You know, I think about a church in a Lutheran church in northeastern Argentina, so from my year in South America, where that church had been founded by Swedish immigrants, you know, a century plus prior. This was a church that had like a Swedish flag in Argentina in the basement. I kid you not, pictures of the Swedish royal family, like, over the buffet line, like, in the fellowship hall kind of stuff. And so their pastor, who was decidedly not Swedish, actually, he had was by ancestry German, but had grown up in Brazil. It's the whole other interesting piece of life in South America, is it is nowhere near as, like, culturally monolithic as I think we tend to think of it as. But anyways, like, Clovis was trying to, again, like, challenge him to, like, no, it's like, our identity is we're people who follow Jesus, we're people who have a certain understanding of the gospel, we're people who live in a certain community in 2008, 2009, and look at our neighbors and, you know, are might well ask, what can we do about the things that we see in our community? At a church meeting, a family stood up and screamed that the purpose of their church's existence was because somos suecos, we're Swedes. And they literally changed the locks and, like, so he could not come into church on a Sunday morning. It's like, that's a radical example of, like, the kind of stuff there. But, like, I wish I could say that every church, including every church in the ELCA, was doing this for the same reasons that we are, which I'd like to thank our wise reasons for being together as a, you know, a faith community. But unfortunately, there are folks for whom, you know, well, my great-great-grandparents were Swedish, so that's why I go to the Lutheran church. And our purpose looks like having lutefisk twice a year, which, God help you, but that is two times a year too many for me. But, like, it's, again, like, I am grateful that I have not found myself in a community that's what I've got to come up against. No, because we're almost done. All right, well, say, unless somebody else has another question, comment, observation, I think we can probably land things right at somos suecos.
I would like to say that I'm so glad the Lutheran Church has changed like it has. As a child, what I was hearing was, you weren't going to get to heaven no matter what you did. Because everything you did was wrong.
Which, how radical a departure that is, too, from, like, literal Martin Luther. Like, you know, like, dude whose name's in the church name, like, ideas. Like, a friend of mine growing up, like, actually at the Christian school, whose family was Lutheran, and they started going to one of the Methodist churches in town. It was the exact same thing. It was like, oh, it's just like, law, law, rule, rule, do this, don't do that, and God's angry at you all the time. It was like, Martin Luther, like, literally said, like, no, that's not what this is about. Like, this is, like, the complete opposite of his teaching, and yet the fact of it is that, like, there are so many examples of exactly that, of, you know, churches where you'd go in and the sermon would be, like, if it was 15 minutes long, it would be 14 minutes of the bad stuff you had done during that week and, like, 1 minute of, but God is gracious and loving, and maybe you'll be all right. Who knows?
I was terrible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, same. It's like, and I grew up Southern Baptist, but I mean, it's like, that's kind of the reputation there in the Southern Baptist Convention. It's like, you know, they've got the market on hellfire and brimstone, like, pretty well saturated. So it just, like, gobsmacks me so much that that is, like, where so many Lutherans were at, especially, like, kind of mid-century, like, you know, 40s, 50s, and 60s stuff. Like, still very living memory. I'm like, man, talk about missing the script.
It didn't make you feel like you really wanted to know
Jesus. That was like not if this is how he treats his friends.
What? I was so terrified. I go to bed at night and have dreams that the devil was coming up out of the ground to get me. I just lived so many years that way. This is crazy. Well, once I got older, I realized how crazy it was.
Right.
Because I was just terrified.
Now, it's always so wild. And it, though, again, like, I relate to it because the same sort of deal of, like, you know, I suppose, like, the one saving grace of the church that I grew up with was that Brother Sid was a really lousy preacher. So while there was lots of hellfire and brimstone, it was poorly delivered enough to where I was not, didn't totally buy it slash had zoned out. And was just like actually reading the Bible, which my mom, one day, I just remember her saying, it's like, you know, you probably should be listening to Brother Sid preach, but you're reading your Bible in church, and I can't really be upset at you for doing that, so just maybe try to tune in a little bit more instead of blatantly not listening to him. So I just learned how to kind of like adjust the Bible in my eyes so I could look up, like, at the pulpit often enough and, you know, still be able to read. But no, I mean, it's the same stuff of, like, why would I want to be, like, what makes this God worth worshiping? Like, if it's a God where I'm, the fear of the Lord looks like I'm afraid that, you know, I'm going to go to hell despite, you know, all of my best intentions and efforts to the contrary. Right. And like, I get that idea of like, you know, because I will admit, at least I grew up in the once saved, always saved kind of camp of Southern Baptists, to where, you know, once you, you know, make your public profession of faith and stuff, like, you're good. But then at that point, it just becomes again, it's like, well, now that you're part of the club, you know, here's what you signed up for. It was like, okay, so like the grace and mercy part is like good for approximately 5 minutes, and from here on out it's all do this, don't do that. And by the way, like, the list of things not to do includes like drinking, dancing, like secular entertainment, and literally anything remotely fun. It's like, yeah, great sales pitch there, team. Sure.
So don't keep browbeating yourself down. You will be forgiven, so.
But it's only in certain parts of heaven, because the Islam people go to the heaven where there's 72 virgins for them.
Well, let us say that I feel like every express, like, again, like, what I keep coming back to is the idea that, for me, like, I find God is a strikingly universal concept that nearly every place and time has an ability to connect with and depiction of. And then human beings get involved with creating the religious structures around it. And this is where we get 72 virgins in heaven and crusades. And oh, and only one part in the Quran, yeah. Right.
And it, do this thing, and then
yep. And unfortunately, as is the case too, like, with, again, every religion, those folks are the ones who are very, very good at finding the microphones, grabbing them and being the, like, this is the word of the Lord. It was like, while the other 90% of us are kind of looking going like, Is it? Okay, well, that seems like a good place to stop for the week. No, thank you guys for sticking around. Obviously, next week, we